All right, Twex podcast. Exciting.
Woohoo!
We finally got everything working after some fun Skype issues earlier that you missed out on, Jack. You didn't get to experience the fun Skype issues. We were a little worried that when you got on, it was going to be like, oh, we're going to start talking. He's not going to be able to connect. We're going to have to sign out, sign in again, try things on other machines.
It wouldn't even be the worst technical difficulties we've ever had for
That's
a podcast.
True. That is a good point. We had some pretty bad technical difficulties during that first Imagine Industries one. Okay, so we tend to start off with introductions. So I'm going to go ahead and let you guys introduce yourselves first.
Okay, I'll go. I'm Jim Fazzetti. I draw the pictures for Unicorn Soup.
And I'm Jack Janey, and I write the word.
Excellent. I'm Brandon. I draw the pictures for Twext.
My name's Colin, and I write the words. We liked it enough that we're gonna copy.
Just like
in rehearsal.
Exactly, just like that full rehearsal we did. It's funny, you actually didn't try and derail that at all. You let that happen.
I did.
That was impressive. Normally, Colin, when we do the introductions these days, tries to come up with some random non sequitur to throw in there, but
chief cook and bottle washer.
Exactly.
It's a very important job when it comes to doing a webcomic.
Yeah,
people don't realize.
But if the bottles are not clean, then everything goes to hell.
The intricacies.
That's a life lesson that I've learned over the last 8 months. I have a new baby, so now my whole life revolves around sterile bottles. So sterile zones are really important for me. So I'm glad that you are a sterile zone person as well. That's important.
And yet with all the sterility, it always seems like everything is a giant mess, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, yes.
Children are, their primary function is to illustrate for you the principles of the second law of thermodynamics. And also the phenomenon of irreversibility. That's what children are for.
That sure is a thing. Oh, yeah, they eat, they poop, they puke, they sleep. Sometimes, right?
Yes.
And they endear. They also endear. There is that. So that's
they'd have to. If they didn't do that, they would be gone. You'd be taking them back the first day.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a defense mechanism. You have to be as cute as possible because you're going to shit on everything.
I'm just gonna throw this out there. I learned a life lesson.
Okay.
And one life lesson I learned in having my son was that when you change an infant, remember the changing pad. The changing pad, for those of you who don't know, is something you place under the infant when you change them.
Okay.
And, you know, I feel like I'm pretty adept when I do things, you know, and I get patterns down well, which is why I like the game, of course. And so I felt like I was a pro diaperer about 4 months in. And so I decided that I could diaper him on the floor with pad on our new carpet. Because, like he says, we decided that our baby needed new carpet to crawl on. And, of course, new almost white carpet. That was our...
Oh, yeah, it was brilliant.
Is there any chance you can blame it on the lack of sleep?
I blame almost everything on that these days, and so getting tired...
Yeah, it is, yeah. It, we've heard it enough.
I apologize to Jim for it, because he's getting... So I thought, you know, I can get this, I can change this diaper. And for those of you who don't know about bowel movement, they often don't come just in one movement. They'll often come in two or three with short stops in between, usually for the baby to mock you. And so I decided to change the diaper, went for it without a pad, all over the carpet, of course. I thought, okay, he's gone. I can change him now. He'll be fine. I started in again. cleaned him up, was getting the diaper, and he went again on the carpet. So, life lesson.
What a good learn.
Yeah, well, and there are two here for those of you who aren't parents. One, get the new carpet after children are older. And then, of course, would be that the pad is essential.
I'm writing all of this down. It is very important.
There's something about kids, when you get the diaper off, that's the signal for them to go.
Right.
And particularly if it's a little boy.
Yeah.
You have to keep a shield up or you will get it in the face.
Oh, and I have heard nothing but stories. We don't
have any war stories ourselves.
But friends of ours, Stephen in particular, with his daughter actually managed a poop spray onto the drapes.
Like 3 feet up.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, if you're a baby, though, and your entertainment options are limited. I mean, you can't game, you really can't watch movies, and so the one entertainment you have, of course, is, you know, peeing on people. I mean, that's always going to be funny. It's always going to get a laugh. So.
And you can't be angry. You can't be angry at the kid.
My daughter had a habit of vomiting on me, even up until she was two or so. And, we had some diet issues that we had to sort out, but it was every couple of nights I'd hear her calling from her bedroom that she didn't feel well, you know, crying, and she would wait, she would hold it until I was within range. If I were at the door, she's fine. As soon as you grab her, then bam, all over, everywhere.
See, now it's worse if the kid is also talking, I imagine, because then it's like, ha ha, got you.
Yeah, right. Well, it's, This was mostly pre-verbal for her, which is probably good for her. It ensured her survival.
I would get, call her your little boomer at any point.
This was before Left 4 Dead, unfortunately, because that would have been the perfect name. Right. That's exactly the kind of
boomer. That's exactly really what happened. Boomer bile down. Everywhere.
Yeah. Something I never managed in Left 4 Dead was the distance of range, but that's a different story.
Yeah, when you're actually the boomer, it can be very difficult.
I think Spitter is also probably a pretty realistic thing.
Yeah.
Oh, God, it's a...
Now, when you're getting into the toddler years, we're talking jockey.
Yes. And also the hunter, because they will pounce your face, and, I mean, my son is only 8 months old, but... he's torn me up pretty good already. I mean, he will get on you and go.
Oh yeah, those claws. I mean, my niece was like that. I mean, she's really, really bad with the claws, with the nails. I mean, and I have a goatee, so she sees that, and it's just like,
yeah. Ooh, toddlers call grab that a handle. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, they do. Yeah.
But it's not just a grab. It's not just a handle. It's like, I not only want to hold that, I would like to remove it if possible.
Right, yeah.
Perhaps wear it herself. Well, I think that through this discussion, I think that we see the genesis of Valve's character creation for their zombies. For their
apparently there are a lot of parents on the Left 4 Dead team.
I don't want to know what kind of dysfunctional family has the tank, but
or the charger, charger for that matter.
Yeah.
This kid's got a really, really big arm. Oh my God, that would make a great enemy in this.
Yeah, there is a selfish part of every dad that most dads are able to keep down. But the tank may not literally manifest itself in the family, but I definitely would feel the tank. Usually after I was covered in vomitus.
You'd hear some kind of music come up to say, "Oh crap, it's the tank music. It's
going
to happen."
Yeah, I'm done for.
My background. Well,
my wife would, you know, call. She works nights. At the time, she wasn't working from home. She was in an office, and she would call and to check on, you know, how things went. And she would hear it from, you know, from me at that point. What happened? She did it again, you know, at that point. The laundry room scraping vomit off of sheets or something. I had, you know, the kid never got that end of it. My wife heard about it. So yeah, I think the tank is a real element there too.
No question about it. And of course the sobbing witch.
Oh yes. Yes. Well. That rapid change in emotion. Right. Just all of a, like you know, maybe a little happy, but then like seems like really, really sad, and then all of a sudden, I will kill everything.
Right. And you stay as quiet as you can to try and avoid that. But somebody always
turn the flashlights off.
Oh, I left my flashlight on. Crap. Oh, it's over. It's on me. That's on me, guys. Sorry. So that's
It's an emotional roller coaster for sure. Absolutely.
And I can imagine that. This is one of the things I really like about your strip. I really like about Unicorn Soup is that your comics. I mean, you're doing a video game strip, but it's very almost journal. You get to see elements that you don't see in a lot of other gaming strips, which is the family interactions, and I think that's what really sets you guys apart. It's a really, really unique way to do things. Not a lot of people put that much of themselves out there, and I think that's really awesome because it really does feel like there's kind of that window into your gaming lives and your family life at the same time.
It's definitely a part of the experience. You know, our lives are hilarious. I mean, shit goes on all the time, and if you don't keep that perspective that this is actually funny, you know, even when you're covered in vomit, then you're going to be unhappy an awful lot. And
you gotta laugh at these things.
So we laugh at it, and then, oh yeah, this makes a great comic. And,
yeah.
From there.
And just a lot of it too is that it's inspired by life, I think, sometimes. And of course there's hyperbole tied in as well. And but I think that one thing that both Jim and I want to do is we want to find the funny and in the everyday, the funny in the things that are relatable to people, because I think a lot of other comics that exist, they do really well sort of satire of games or satire of gaming culture. But the day-to-day lives of gamers, I think there's a lot of amusing things there, and there's a lot of amusing material to work with. And you can kind of dial up the absurdity, we did a strip called When the Wife's Away, and the central joke there is just that when your wife leaves the house, men kind of descend into this sort of Cro-Magnon state where they're like any semblance of their civility or civilized selves kind of falls away. And so there's a joke in there about some sexual act with a bottle of Aunt Jemima syrup.
I enjoyed that one.
Mrs. Butterworth.
You know, I always make that mistake. Right, Mrs. Butterworth. Excuse me. And
don't get me wrong, Aunt Jemima is attractive as well, but Mrs. Butterworth has got going on.
There's just something about
it. Right. But you know, I think that any husband or any man who's in a relationship, I think they see an element of truth in that, and the hyperbole is obviously there. But
there's a huge element of relatability there.
Yeah, we be relatable and also sort of also honest. You know,
what he's trying to say is that we laugh because we can't cry.
And it's difficult to cry when you're having a sexual experience with Mrs. Butterworth.
Yeah, it's after the crying and the cutting.
And she's very understanding generally about it.
She listens to my wants and my needs. And it's so we did talk about this a bit before we started, but now that you're both here, I wanted to ask, how did you guys get Unicorn Soup started? I mean, you guys are in different time zones, and you're collaborating on a strip together, and talk a bit about how that got started.
Well, and we've actually never met either. Jim's met my brother a few times. And
oh wow!
Yeah, his brother lives in the same state, about 4 hours away. But Tash has got a mountain range, or Jack rather has a mountain range between himself and I. And
I've got quite a few mountain ranges.
That's true. There's a handful.
Yeah, and hers is above them.
It started with Team Fortress 2.
Yep.
We ended up, you know, on each other's friends list on Xbox Live. That was actually why I bought an Xbox, was to play Team Fortress. And because I, like I was telling you guys earlier, I was getting off of the PC gaming treadmill. I didn't want to stick with Windows, which I knew would probably limit my game options. So I bought an Xbox, got Team Fortress 2, because I love Team Fortress Classic. And it wasn't very long into that before I was playing games with Jack and his friends. And a multiplayer game like that was attractive to me because it avoids that element that you might find in Halo or Call of Duty. It's a game that requires maturity because it requires thought and strategy.
Right.
And it was great to play with people who weren't using the N word for anything they didn't like, or the F word, the longer F word, not the shorter one. And it was great to play with people who didn't rage quit, who didn't...
Well, it's not all about ego in Team Fortress.
No, it's not. But
it, mine,
you know,
was tied very closely to it, my performance.
So. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, I was just being absurd. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Sorry. The lost my train of thought.
The
fact that we didn't rage quit, the fact that we had these people who were okay losing but wanted to win, you know, still competitive, meant that, you know, I was playing with these guys more and more, and we were playing every night. And then Tash came up with the idea of the Venture Brothers. And you can take over the story from there, I think.
Yeah, and so I had actually bought an Xbox in a very similar time frame because I was getting off the World of Warcraft treadmill. My brother and I had played World of Warcraft for quite a while, and we burned out on it before the first expansion, bought an Xbox, Team Fortress. I played Half-Life 2 on my PC, and so I was a big Valve fan. And then, yeah, like Jim said, wound up playing with a lot of... it's interesting, on Xbox Live, oftentimes similar people will sort of group up, or people who are similar ages, or, you know, I think it's that sort of, it's that old nugget about birds of a feather and all that. And
the commonality of experience.
Yeah. And it's really fascinating how that happens on this kind of anonymous gaming social network. But anyway, playing Team Fortress, and I kind of try to get a loose guild or group of gamers going together that would sort of play competitively, but still have a, yeah. I don't know if a lighthearted approach is right, but like Jim said, being okay losing.
I think lighthearted is good. And the big issue for me is that it wasn't actually a clan. I didn't want practice times. I didn't want to be scheduled.
No, this was a group of like-minded individuals just playing games together.
Exactly, and you know, and so we did that, and I set up a couple matches with other groups and stuff like that, and whether or not we won or lost was sort of immaterial, because whereas I'm sure on the other side they were furiously you know, strategizing and complaining and fighting and arguing, we just laughed and had a great time together. So
go from kind of talking about the action and making fun of each other and other people and having that great time online to being like, hey, I'm an artist, and hey, I'm a writer.
Right. Well, and so kids, you know, kids out there, if you want to create something wonderful, and if you want to create art, if you want to create comics, get on Xbox Live and tell your parents you're building relationships that will help you ultimately to achieve these goals.
It was a few games later. I mean, it was the genesis, the fact that we got as comfortable with each other as we did, and with this group of friends, it was owed almost entirely to, and I hate to do this because I don't like Microsoft as an entity, but we owe it entirely to the party chat. But we also owe it to Valve, because Team Fortress was a game that allowed us to find each other and play together, and you know, which you couldn't do with a lot of different multiplayer games that do the matchmaking, that sort of thing. Some games it's hard for us to play together, simply because it's not geared up for a bunch of friends to get in a game together.
Right.
And anyway, yeah. A few games later, we went through Left 4 Dead and Assassin's Creed. I think it was probably during Assassin's Creed when one of the, at this point we knew that Jack could write, and they'd seen my website with my paintings and that sort of thing. One of our friends said, "You guys should totally make a webcomic together." And we thought, okay.
So it wasn't even your idea.
No, it wasn't even our idea.
No, you know, I've been doing kind of a gaming-related blog for a while.
Yeah,
And although I would write about stuff like banana bread, and I would insert, like, nerdery into banana bread, I talk about mashing the bananas with Glamdring, Gandalf's sword, of course. And I have a replica, so I put photos in there. And just, you know, just stuff like that. And then Jim has had a website, and I think still does.
I haven't done anything with it, but yeah, it's there.
Yeah, that,
it sure does
displayed
exist.
A lot of his artwork. And so we just we dove in, and I wrote a couple scripts. And actually, Jim is a great collaborator because as a writer, and I hadn't written comics before, and it's a really unique genre to try to write because words rather than being beneficial, oftentimes words are a detriment to your comic. You know, you want to keep it as sort of succinct as you can, and I'm very wordy, and so the first couple of scripts I sent Jim, he just went through and just tore them up. Which was,
I disemboweled them.
Yeah, he did. Eviscerated them completely. But see, that's actually a good thing for me.
But he was sending me scripts that, you know, he had separated them out into panels, but either the panels would be entirely text or I would have to stretch it into a 4-page comic, you know, or 5 or 6.
It was
learning.
Yeah, I am learning. And
me too. I mean, I've got to learn how to do all this crap too. I've done a few comics before this, but nothing regular.
Right. Well, and so, you know, there are a lot of creators out there who are creating these comics by themselves, and I just think they're amazing talents because, like, for me, I need that individual to be brutally honest with me to eviscerate my work when it needs to be eviscerated,
So many of our ideas are from us hanging out. They're from that collaborative space.
You start to play off of each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it becomes a natural part of... It wouldn't turn out the same if you were trying to create that idea on your own. There's something about that back-and-forth play that leads to creating something.
Absolutely.
Beyond if it was just yourself.
And you know, if you're on your own, who's that sounding board? Who's that guy telling you, no, sorry, that's not funny, or no, that doesn't look right.
Incidentally enough, it's yourself.
And that can be a problem. When it comes to artwork, I'm my own worst critic, and I'd been toying with the idea or wanting to do a comic for a long time, but could never get past that internal critic killing everything.
Right.
Amazing.
You know, because and Jim, I didn't mean to cut you off, but it's a little amazing because like Jim's artwork is fabulous.
Absolutely.
And,
stellar.
Yeah, and so what I had to learn as a writer was that I didn't have to write everything. I didn't have to write all the interactions, that Jim could actually scaffold a lot of what I was doing with his art. So if I had a joke that I wanted to tell, Jim could actually, you know, have the character's emotions display that, or have their body posture, or however he lays everything out. And that, as a writer, that's so liberating. And so then, you know, whereas the medium itself makes it so I can't actually use all the words I want to use, Jim, as an artist and as a partner in this, it just helps me tremendously because he can do all that heavy lifting for me, or at least a lot of it.
Yeah, you know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And the problem is that Tash was putting 1,000 words in the dialogue instead of in the descriptions of the panels. And that was just at first. And once he got the hang of it and realized that, you know, the person doesn't have to say, "I am angry." All I have to do is make the eyebrows pointy towards the nose, you know. Hey,
right.
We're done. It's easier.
But he picked up on that really quick. I haven't had to touch his scripts lately. He knows exactly what he's doing, and it makes it really easy for me too, because I can see where it needs to go. He makes it clear, you know, the important visual elements, and then I, like you said, I built the rest of the scaffold around it.
We often, when we're kind of laying an idea out, we'll have a basic concept of the joke, but I won't write the words, the script as you're calling it, usually until I already have the art.
You finalize often
because I find
what they say.
There's so much in the art that Brandon provides me with that I can work with that sometimes some of the words aren't necessary, sometimes I want to change slightly how they're said. You know, the facial expression says it all there, so now I don't have to even go into that
right
kind of a thing.
That's essentially what we were doing. I would just tell Tash, you know, I'll take care of this part.
Right.
We do work backwards relative to you guys. He comes up with the script, and then I do the pictures.
And I structure it loosely. I mean, just I guess from kind of a working perspective, I structure it loosely like a screenplay, very loosely.
It's structured like a traditional comic book script is. He divides it up into panels, has a description of the action of the panel, and then has the dialogue, and any other stage instructions that might be in there.
Jim will send me some notes. And usually issues that I have with the initial script, I'll just send him like, hey, I don't know about this bit of dialogue or, the repetition of this word or how the show gets coming across. We work pretty well together. And I think one reason that we work so well is that neither of us is very sensitive.
we're both insensitive pricks. So.
Yes, we are. And so, if Jim criticizes my writing, I don't think it's personal. It doesn't matter, it's a script. He's talking about the script, not about me. He might talk about me, I don't know. But Right, exactly. And so, neither of us is very sensitive about the process, because ultimately our goal is to produce something that's quality. And
that's
so,
funny joke. Yeah.
And that can be the harder part about collaborations. I mean, I have an unbelievable amount of respect for the people that do regularly a strip completely on their own, because all of this is happening internally. They have to get to a point with themselves that they're their own, they're their best supporter, and at the same time their worst critic. They have to be able to push past the criticism to get to the point where they have a final product. They have to agree that they're happy with the final product with themselves. As soon as you have a collaboration, you have two individuals that are combining to do this, that part becomes easier, but at the same time, you have to be very good at communicating. You have to be good at being able to take criticism, suggestions, thoughts, ideas, because maybe, you might have received an idea for the layout for a strip, and maybe there's something you think maybe we should do this differently. And obviously you guys had that as part of your process. Sorry?
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of static. I don't know.
Oh, you're getting... Is it... How about now?
Yeah, it's when you're speaking.
Yeah, it's not... I can hear Jim fine, but...
We're getting a little bit of noise on Brandon's end, but that's fine.
Yeah. But, as a point, I think that... Guys like Davis, who are... producing multiple strips by themselves over Legacy Control.
Yes.
I don't know how he does it.
Particularly because he's also got a job and a family and kids, which to me, that's just not something that I could see.
Right. Well, and
working.
He absolutely works unbelievably hard on the strip. He does not have an easy road. I think that's another thing. Collaboration makes that easier because you're splitting up some of that workload, and for him, I mean, he's doing all of it.
Yeah. I'm still picking that static up, and so I'm just going to mention while you look at the static, I'm just going to talk about, you know, like, as a writer, I know that one thing that I had to overcome was sort of the sense of insecurity when I'm putting those things out there, especially when you're writing comedy. Because writing comedy is really hard. Like, because you might think it's funny or amusing, but, you know, trying to figure out if anyone else will is, it's really kind of daunting and intimidating. And you know, talking to Jim and sharing my ideas with Jim, it's good to have a collaborator because he can sort of let me know if it's funny or not, and even if it works or not. And there, you know, there, I can think of a handful of scripts that for one reason or the other, we've just sort of kind of left by the wayside, just because I couldn't work it out, and, you know, between the two of us, we couldn't.
Currently table.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they have something there, we just haven't been able to uncover yet, you know?
I
haven't been able to polish it to the right shine.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
but,
you know, like, Javis, I he's putting out 3 a week, and that's all the credit in the world goes to him, you know, to be able to do that, and to be able to sort of do the art and overcome that sort of, you know, writer's insecurity that I know that I feel when I'm producing comedy. I want to make sure it's funny.
Yeah.
And so.
No, absolutely. Now, how are we sounding now? Let's just
much
do
better.
Okay,
much
good.
Better, yeah.
I didn't know if maybe that was it was an internet thing. You might have had a reindeer standing on your cable line or something.
You know what it is? It's probably
a moose.
It's a moose. Yeah. Yes, exactly. The moose are chewing on the internet lines that we have.
Well, they have so much Molson ice, and then they wander through randomly.
Oh, Molson, really? Really, Molson? We're gonna bring Molson into this.
It's the only Canadian domestic I can think of.
You know what? Like, we all, if people know about Canadian beer, they know about Molson. Molson. And Labatt are kind of the two beers that most of us kind of cringe about the most, because they're the most known. But you know what?
The ones that are exported. It's the same here, but
it's watery crap. Is what it is. I mean, we drink.
It's the old Monty Python line, right? American beer is like having sex in a canoe. It's fucking close to water. I think it's North American beer is, I think, you know, nice. You can put it that way.
We have so many good beers here, though, that you just don't even see.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's going to be the case. The best ones just aren't going to be distributed on the, like the water. Like, you know, the Miller and the Coors or the Molson.
Ugh.
Those guys are producing, you know, millions of gallons more. It's a good reason not to drink it, for sure.
Mass-produced.
A good Oregon plug for where Jim is. Oregon has a lot of fabulous microbrews.
Absolutely.
It's a great place for them.
Yeah. It's, I have been, it's my personal mission to only drink Oregon beer and try a different one every chance I get. And I've got, it's going to be a few years before I get through the list here.
We're pretty good about that too. We have a lot of microbreweries, and we have a beer and rib festival that happens every year, where we get to try a lot of those new beers and get absolutely shit-faced. It's good to know. We're all kind of alcohol snobs. I like it.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're gonna destroy your liver, do it right. You know,
Do it with something that tastes right. Don't
this,
do
this
it
is a
bit
of a strange correlation I've noticed, but among a lot of people I associate with, gamers appear to be alcohol snobs. Maybe this just goes along with the general nerdiness.
Yeah.
It does, right? I mean, if you're really into video games, you're really into figuring out complex new systems, and beer is a complex system.
Yeah.
And the way it's marketed, and the way it tastes, and the way everybody can make something slightly different, that all of those little elements are like that's candy for a nerd, you know.
Absolutely.
For anybody who likes to know a lot about a small, you know, one single topic, you know, beer is a great place to jump in.
Here in for us anyway, we also really love our rye, and I don't know how much you guys are into the harder stuff, but we treat it very much the same way.
It's Rye specifically isn't something that I have a whole lot of experience with. But,
well, it's much bigger here, I think.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely, yeah, I think that's definitely true.
We have a stupid number of options when it comes to Canadian whiskeys. It's just, our liquor stores have entire walls dedicated to your just Canadian whiskeys.
Yeah, yeah, we definitely have fewer options for what you guys are making. I guess because you're drinking it all. but there are a few of those, and you know, whiskey is a big American drink too. Bourbon specifically is, I think, probably treated the same way here as your rye is. I've been exploring that area too. You know, trying to find the stuff that doesn't kill you, and actually tastes good. Once I realized that, you know, gin that tastes like hairspray is bad gin, and there is actually gin that tastes good, you know, I mean, it just opened up a whole new world. Well, all sorts of ways for, you know, killing oneself.
this alcohol moment has been brought to you by Forty Creek Whiskey. Forty Creek Whiskey. That's right. Yeah.
Which, by the way, is our very favorite rye.
I know that name.
From 40 Creek, it's the best.
Yeah, I've seen it at the liquor outlet. I'll go pick it up.
It's actually brewed in our hometown that we grew up in. It's created there.
There's always something nice about having that kind of local option, right? Mm-hmm. Having that connection to where it was actually produced. The homebrewing thing is also really interesting too. Going back to beer, my father-in-law does this, and I've been reading up on it a lot. And if I could afford the space and yet another hobby, I'd definitely be looking into that.
I would be terrified to try.
You know, I was going to start simple. I have a lot of Hispanic friends, and there's a traditional Hispanic drink. I forget the name of it now, but it's a wild fermented liquor made from pineapple skins, essentially.
Whoa.
And it's so easy because it's wild fermented, right? So you take the skin of a pineapple, you put it in a clay pot, you add a piponcillo, which is around about 3/4 of a cup of essentially brown sugar. It's raw sugar, which is a little different. Fill it with water just so it covers the pile of crap you just put in there. Lightly cover it, put it in a dark closet, come back in a couple of weeks, and you have a liquor.
What?
Yes.
We have to
and
try this.
Oh my God, we have to try this.
There's going to be what will be called a mother on top, right? It's a skim of mold, essentially. You take that off, you don't drink that, you throw that away. But the liquor underneath, he says it's different every time because it's wild fermented. Sometimes it's really good.
If
it was really good, you keep a little bit of that mother and you put that into the next jar and you'll get, you know, a closer drink to what you had last time. You know, shit. I mean, there's no carboys, there's no mash brewing, there's, you know, not even using a densitometer. You're putting some crap in a closet and then checking on it. I think I can manage this, you know?
Oh my God. So, wow, that is awesome.
To be honest, I have no idea if it's also possible to kill yourself with this experiment.
It could be.
Quick disclaimer. We do not claim any responsibility for any alcohol that you try to now make in your closet. Twex.com claims no responsibility for any deaths or miscarriages. Twex Podcast, more than just webcomics. That's super cool.
Yeah, that we have brewing and life left, so we're really bringing it all together.
I'm gonna have to try that now.
You know, to bring it a little more back on track, there was something I wanted to go back and touch on. That idea of being able to collaborate together, that Jack and I have managed. I think the reason it's working so smoothly for us is because of, you know, 3 or 4 years of Team Fortress 2 and Left 4 Dead and games where we've been collaborating every night, only been shooting digital people in the face, you know. It's only a slight stretch to go from.
It's amazing, you know, how those things bring people together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it really. And then, you know, like our frames of reference then become so similar, you know, because there's that sort of nerdy frame of reference, you know, with the gaming. And then, of course, when you're gaming regularly with people, you know, you talk about movies and books and music and those things. So then, yeah, collaborating is really easy for that.
Yeah. We basically cover all of that, all of the background material, you know,
right,
while you were poning noobs, I think.
Yes.
So I had a question, and then I think Colin has one that he wanted to ask you about. So I'm gonna start with mine quickly, and this one is more for Jim than anything. So your style is very unique. Not only do you do black and white, but it is very realistic. It's very classic. We're talking like independent black and white comics style. And it is so crisp and unique for a gaming strip, and just you emote everything so well using the style. I was just wondering, how did you come upon doing the strip in this style? Is kind of my question, because it's really unique for the kind of comic you guys are doing.
Well, I appreciate that. There's a combination of things going on. One of the more important elements is that I was classically trained. I went to an art school that was way too expensive, but actually taught people how to draw and how to paint, as opposed to where a lot of art programs are going now, is trying to teach you how to be a unique flower or something. This was a program that was designed to produce commercial art professionals,
right?
And I've always had I've been of the persuasion that the illustrators are artists. In fact, they're better artists than a lot of the artists I see out there. A lot of the folks that would be called fine artists don't have the kind of skills that an illustrator has, at least traditionally. Well,
right.
Even today, there are some really fantastic illustrators out there that are producing artwork for magazines, you know, editorial or even advertising work that is better than stuff hanging on gallery walls. So I had that kind of approach and background. I also have a love of that look in comics, the 30s, 40s, 50s adventure comics, for example, like Terry and the Pirates or Steve Canyon. Milton Caniff is the guy who drew Canyon and some of Terry the Pirates, and he's just brilliant with pen and ink, or brush and ink, really. And
right.
There's some very old Japanese comics along those lines that I really like. Goseki Kojima, who did the Lone Wolf and Cub stuff. I mean, so these are guys who were working purely black and white, with essentially limited tools, and producing absolutely amazing things. I wanted to be one of these guys. I'm not. I mean, I'm nowhere near their talent or their ability, but I'm looking at them for inspiration. But also, when it comes down to what we call style, I'll try to cut this short because I can talk for 5 hours about this.
we'll save that for another podcast sometime.
My personal opinion is that the style comes naturally. It's an opinion I actually have taken from one of my teachers. When we were in art school and we were all struggling to figure out who we were as artists and illustrators and you know, what our thing was going to be, this teacher, and a few of them actually, basically made it clear that you don't do that. You learn how to draw, you learn how to see, you learn how to observe. You cannot prevent your own personal style from pervading your work. Even when you're copying somebody, it still came through your eyes, your brain, your hand, and informs the work.
Which is good, because that still makes you a unique flower.
Right, you're still going to be a unique flower. You cannot help but be a unique flower, and that's kind of what they were saying. So stop trying so hard. Just get out there and draw the damn thing. And while I do, you know, look to, you know, my heroes, when I'm drawing a comic, I am really trying more to just be in the now, just solve the problem that's in front of me. and right. I'm not thinking about it in terms of how did Milton Caine do this. Unless I get stuck, get myself in a corner and need, you know, help getting out, then, oh, well, Caine did it this way, Kojima did it that way, you know, oh, I can, you know, crib from one of these guys.
Right.
So that's kind of what's going on when the comic is drawn.
No, I mean, I did not go through the same process that you did. I don't have any formal training, as it were. I've drawn since I could hold a pencil, and got out of it for a little while due to some interesting side history that I won't get into too much depth about, because that tends to take up more time than I like it to.
Another podcast
yet again. But basically, I pursued another vocation, and then I got out of it, and then I got into IT, and then in that, I got back into drawing, and you're absolutely right. I mean, your teachers were right. I mean, trying to find your style is not, it's not a thing. You can't, you don't find it, it finds you. You have to observe, you have to draw a lot, In some cases, that means just drawing something that's in front of you. In some cases, that means absorbing the work of others. But as you draw, your style naturally evolves. You're not going to be able to replicate somebody else. You're not going to... It's got to come over time.
It evolves if you let it. I mean, it is going to come over time, but you have to be open to it, you have to be receptive to that, and you have to allow it to happen.
Right.
A lot of kids, when they start off, you know, drawing comics, not necessarily web comics, just, you know, when they're drawing comic-type things, they see, for example, how Garfield is drawn exactly the same way every day, and they think that's what they have to do. That they have to come up with a specific way that you're going to draw this character, and you have to draw him the same way every day. And they're preventing themselves from growing in a situation like that, in my opinion. There are a lot of comics out there, just in the newspapers. I had a chance to look at a newspaper over Christmas because my mother gets it and was visiting, and I haven't looked at newspaper comics in a long time.
Right.
And I find it very depressing that in this particular newspaper, all 3/4 of the comics were by dead people. I mean, they're you know, in the other ones, some of the newer ones were visually illegible. There's one that has a, I guess it's a dog, but he's got, the way they draw its ears, they're like, they look like batarangs. Floating in the air above his head, and I couldn't figure out why somebody was constantly throwing batarangs at this thing until I realized that, oh, those are ears. You know, this person had taken that idea of having to develop a consistent visual look
and then decided
so
that
far that
floating batarangs.
I didn't know what the fuck I was looking at.
Well, Brandon, you can probably talk to consistent visual look. Yes.
Oh God, yeah, no. So I mean. Consistent visual look, I mean, screw that. I never was able to be satisfied with the way I drew my characters. I mean, I think that I drew them all the wrong ways to start. And sure. I know that maybe some people might say there's no right or wrong way to do it. And I'm glad for the way that I started, but you have to, if you're not satisfied with the way that you're drawing a character, it's going to become a chore.
Is it?
Long term. And you have to make peace with yourself. You have to be all right. You have to get to a point where, not necessarily that the character is perfect, but you have to get to a point where you're like, okay, you know what? I could draw that character that way, in a similar way, long term, and be happy with it, and then make small, minuscule little tweaks maybe as time goes on, so that it's not too jarring to the audience. But yeah, no, you if you just like, oh yeah, this is how I'm going to draw this, and it's going to be that way forever, and forget anybody who says differently, and
going to be unhappy.
Yeah, that's not the right attitude to have. I absolutely,
you know, I don't like Garfield. I'll just put that out there. Jim Davis, I'm sure, is a really nice guy. I know he's very successful. What I do like is the really early drawings of Garfield before he had figured that out. You know, the very, very early Garfields, I don't know how easy it is to find these days. They had life, they had character, they had personality, because he hadn't been locked into that whole syndicate thing. This is how it has to look, this is how it has to stay.
No, and I think a very similar thing happened.
I love those early stages of comics where you see the artist working.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think even in ours, you know, ours has been going for, I don't know, 6 months or so, and you see a huge development in just the way the characters look, you know, just in sort of, you know, 6 months. And, you know, we probably write 2 or 3 months in advance, probably 2 months in advance. And I know at least early on, you know, Jim's art style especially was making these huge kind of progressive leaps, stylistically. And when we would schedule our comics, sometimes we'd try to schedule them to relate to the games that would be launching at times. And so we'd have a little bit of time traveling that I know was a little frustrating for, you know, for Jim, I think, on the artistic side.
Right.
I had a hard time with the idea that people might look and think, oh, he's getting worse, or he's in his when, you know, there's a, to me, I can see an increase in ability as I'm going on. Everybody has been very supportive, and nobody has complained about it yet. So, obviously, they're not looking. So that's fine.
You see, we are we're week to week, and I'm not going to say that that's a advantage of any kind. We don't have a bank. We've got a bank of ideas, but the strips themselves are created.
There was a time, once upon a time, that I had a backlog. There was a time.
I think we had five.
We had two. Yeah, no, maybe 2 to 5 strips banked. And even then, yeah, you don't have to worry about, when you're only going back that far, you're not going to notice rapid visual style changes as you're posting them. It's not.
Well, and it's also nice because you're not worried about your jokes getting dated. You're generally making them right then and there. And every idea, we have an idea in the bank that quote-unquote expires.
Yeah, that's true.
But
yeah.
We were not wasting actual strips in those cases.
It's definitely a concern for us. But, you know, at the same time, we knew, both of us have families, both of us have jobs. There are going to be weekends where, you know, we can't get this done. You know, we've got a fair amount of physical space in between as well. So having to deal with email and that sort of thing means we've got to work ahead.
Right.
But yeah, a game will come out and we've got a joke for it right now. But if I just put it at the end of the queue, it will come out in 2 months, you know?
Right.
So that's a problem.
You have to work within that limitation.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to juggle. I'm trying to get, my brother does the has helped us set the website up. We're looking for a tool that will help me reschedule comics easily. Because, you know, unfortunately, we have to do that. My current tool means I have to, every comic that is yet to be published, I have to go reschedule each one individually. I'd love to sort of, you know, automate that somehow. We'll find it. WordPress is pretty amazing stuff.
There's a
plugin out there for it already.
Yeah. I would be surprised if there wasn't already a plugin for that, to be honest. So Colin, do you want to, you can ask your question.
And it's interesting, kind of works well into this line of questioning that you call them scripts. We would certainly never use that terminology, but we generally have a shorter form comic. I mean, you know, I found your 1-3 panel and you made the joke. But my question is, do you find that it's difficult to get out there to really excite the masses, so to speak? And I'm not talking about the fans. I'm talking about the random people on the internet who are just kind of stopping by. Do you find it's hard to get that kind of consumer with your longer form comic. Because so many people on the internet these days aren't looking for a series of jokes that they get to read. They're looking for something very snappy, something they can just consume and be done and basically put you out of their minds until maybe something that you put out comes across their desk again.
Right. You know, I guess for me, I write comics that I think are funny. And, you know, I bounce them off Jim, and the people who read ours and who read it regularly, I think that they like it. But I think part of what I want to do, too, is to tell, not necessarily a story, but to sort of have an experience of life a little bit, you know? So that's why, like, a lot of the comics that deal with, you know, relationships or parenting or even gaming, you know, there tends to be at least a little bit of a story there. And just, I guess I'm writing for myself, and I'm hoping that people like it. And I think that it would be harder for me, and I don't know if it would be disingenuous, but it would be harder for me at least to try to force myself into a three-panel.
Well, that's the thing. Your ideas don't seem to stem from punchlines. It's not like, situation set up punch. It's here's a situation that it would be funny to talk about or for our characters to have a discussion about. There's a lot of humor in there, so let's do a page.
Because I don't think
you... has a lot to do with it. I mean, we could take a lot of his scripts and trim them down to a three-panel comic. We would lose a lot.
They wouldn't have the same impact. I mean,
it wouldn't have the same impact. It wouldn't have the same sort of depth, and I would be unhappy. I like this format, and I've been encouraging it because I have a lot more opportunity to draw unusual things than I would in a three-panel. I mean, like you said, if it's, you know, situation set up punch, then I can't get creative with camera angles or action or setting. You know, everything has to be devoted to that very, very tight timing.
Yeah,
we lose a lot, I think.
And I think
we really didn't look at it from a marketing point of view. You know, we didn't think, you know, this is what's going to make us stand out. We didn't think, oh, we're going to sacrifice viewers because we're making it long. We are doing it because we like it this way, and hopefully other people will as well.
And I think that absolutely shows, and I think that they will.
And that's the right attitude to have. I mean, your last strip, the Dance Central one. That one had to be, I mean, it's glorious. I mean, the you go through all the different, you see all the different positions that he can get himself into.
Yeah.
And the people.
I really had a blast drawing that, obviously.
It's fantastic. And I really think that it would lend itself really well to being in almost like book form. I think that if you guys came out with a book with these in it, I think it would do really well, because I think people would read it and be like, oh, hey, I can really relate to this, and I can sit down and read it, kind of a thing, rather than, oh, there's a strip, oh, there's punch, done, next.
Well, anyway, we're certainly not ruling that out. I mean, it's part of our 12-step plan to rule the universe.
I think it's currently number 9. But when I wrote that script, and something I like to do sometimes is to, you know, make cultural references. And so when I wrote that script, I thought, you know, I was thinking of, wouldn't it be funny if Tom Cruise from Risky Business was doing kind of a Dance Central sort of thing? And so in that script, that initial appearance, the character Potable Brick slides in and he puts the game in the same way that Tom Cruise puts the CD in Risky Business, and then he slides in, you know, into the whitey-tighties. And so I think that if you have that three-panel format, and it works great for some folks, but I think it limits me, and it limits what I want to do as a writer and what story I want to tell. Because, I mean, I think I do want to tell these little stories, and that's what I think that's sort of more important.
More of a narrative approach. If we had done the three-panel, I wouldn't have been able to draw all of those, you know, dance positions and that sort of thing. And that, I was just giggling all day as I drew that thing. My wife thought I'd lost it. And, it was too much fun to give up. You know, I don't want to do comics that don't let me do that kind of thing.
Well, and you know, you, you mentioned, Brandon, I think that generally speaking, the comics that do better are the sort of shorter form comics. And there are longer form comics out there, and there are some good ones. But, you know, I think that if as creators, if we're making something that we enjoy and that we love, and that if we're producing a quality product, I think that if people are exposed to these things, they'll have the opportunity to read them. I think that they know that there's an audience for it.
Yeah, I think it just creates a unique challenge there.
Yeah, Field of Dreams, for sure. Yeah,
it creates a different challenge in that yes, the other ones are more consumable, they're a little bit more directly accessible, but at the same time, if you can get people in there, you create something that you're being true to yourself, it's genuinely funny. I think people are still going to be attracted to that.
I think eventually we'll gain enough of a reader base. Yeah, we're lucky in that we both have a way to pay the bills, and we're not desperate to get page views,
right.
You know, or make money off of ads or whatever right away. We can sort of take this more tentative approach, which is, I think ideal, because we don't know what the hell we're doing. We're trying to.
No, they don't.
So, moving it, just one step at a time and doing what we like, means that even if it is a total failure from a marketing or money perspective, we're still having a blast. And so therefore it cannot fail. We're just fine.
Well, kind of taking that theory of art that Jim is talking about, in the same way that, he is that special flower already, and he just has to go out and do it.
I told you.
I think so too. Universe Soup is already that special flower, and we just have to go out and do it, and then whatever the universe provides for, whatever occurs with it, will occur in the long run. But, as Jim said, ultimately, we love what we're doing, we're having a great time with it, and so that's really all we need.
Well, and that said, Jack has been doing a fair amount of marketing here and there. We had a huge hit of a large influx of page views with the Dark Souls comic, because he does a clever sort of grassroots kind of marketing with that.
Right.
And
so what I did there was, and I went on to, Dark Souls hadn't been released yet. It was just before release, I think. And so I went on their Facebook page and then into their forum, and I just sort of did some kind of guerrilla marketing. I emailed everybody who was associated with it, and sent them links to the comic, and then Dark Souls official Facebook page posted a link to our comic.
Nice.
And,
we had 5,000 hits in one day.
Wow.
Well, more than 5,000 plus.
Yeah, and I think we wound up with like 800 or 900 Facebook likes.
It's definitely our most successful comic. Now, as far as retention is concerned, we kept just a fraction of those views. A lot of those folks didn't come back.
Which is, that's normal. I mean,
it's expected.
Very normal.
Because if we weren't doing a consistent Dark Souls comic, that would be 8%. So.
Yeah, and even if we were, that wouldn't last very long anyway, because another game would come out. Folks would go look at something else,
right.
But those kind of tricks help to get a good influx, and some of those people will stay. It's like a cold call in advertising. If you get 1% of the people you contact, if you get 1% to actually make a buy or whatever,
right.
That's considered phenomenal. So if one person stayed from or five people stayed and came back after that particular day, then mission accomplished.
Right.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad we all agreed so definitely on that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've got a question. Unicorn Soup. It's hilarious in itself, and I love the icon that you have for that. Where'd the name come from?
Go ahead. It's Jim's credit for the name. We were banding a couple of names. initially, because and Castle Time was kind of a play on my my wife's remembrance of the name Dragon Age, because I've been playing Dragon Age a lot. And so then when Dragon Age 2 came out, she's like, oh, is this another Castle Time game?
And which kind of, you know, dragons and castles, yeah, and then time and age. I mean, she got close.
It's Castle Time.
That's not bad. I like that, actually.
For caring nothing about gaming, you know, at least she was sort of vaguely playing that. And Jim came up with Unicorn Soup, and I don't know, I don't recall exactly how you came up with that.
I'm not going to lie to you. It came in a dream.
Did it really?
I literally had a dream where the old woman archetype, the wise old lady, you know, the wise old witch with a hellhound at her side,
oh my God,
said that the next thing I do is going to be called Unicorn Soup, and you're going to like it. This was about, literally, this was a week before Voodoo said, hey, you guys should make a comic. And I had to get up in the middle of the night because I knew it was the perfect name, and if I, you know, kept sleeping, I rolled over and went back to sleep, I'd forget it. So I got up in the middle of the night and scrawled it on my drawing table. And I just thought it was so unique and so awesome. And then when we decided to use that name and I went to register the website, there's like 8 or 9, you know, unicorn soups out there. So yeah, it's not exactly unique or awesome in any regard. But it came in a dream, goddammit. And I don't know, I mean, we could find a way for it kind of to tie into the comic, you know, this sort of melange of ideas and you know, definitely fantasy is a huge element here since we're game players. But I just think it's, I like names that could mean a bunch of different things. Is it soup for unicorns? Or is it soup made out of unicorns? So that's why I voted for it.
Yeah.
And then,
well, it's certainly, it's very memorable.
I had a dream where the old lady came to him and said, you do what he says. And then we were,
right. And I acquiesced, and then we had the name.
Like that. So thank you, dream lady.
So what you're telling me is that you've been paying an old woman to go into people's houses, drug them, and then talk to them.
Whisper in their ears at night. That's the creative process, right?
That is the creative process. Every now and again, I have to pay an old woman to drug me. So that I can come up with what I'm going to draw next.
Yeah, it has to be cash under the table, though. She doesn't take checks.
No, no paper trails. No paper trails.
No. Yeah.
So incidentally enough, the next strip I draw could look, you know, very very Dolly, with lots of crutches and melting clocks, but you know.
Right. Those draw, you know, got to worry about the flashbacks too, the after effects.
Yes.
The hallucinogens will stick with me for a while.
Well, guys, we're coming in at just over an hour and 12, on the podcast. So I think what I'll do is I'm just going to say, did you guys have anything specific that you wanted? Any questions or any other little things you wanted to bring up before we wrap things up?
Actually, I think a wrap will be good for me unless you have something to talk about. I've got a baby to attend to, so.
The damn baby.
A baby that's either pooping or eating or peeing or something.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, thanks very much, guys, for coming on with us. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Well, thank you. This is fun.
Yeah, no, and absolutely, like, the invitation is always on the table if you guys decide that you've got some time in the future and we want to set one of these up again, we're always game to do that.
Sounds good to me. I mean, you're asking us to talk about stuff we like. It's hard to shut us up.
Exactly.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, I'm becoming a lot more aware of the time on these podcasts because we've managed to go for easily like over 2 hours, and then those ones I have to chop
in time.
Half
I don't think there's any stopping us.
Yeah.
We could just talk. Yeah. About this kind of thing, anything at all, really, for a stupid amount of time. So
yeah, well, if it means avoiding work, you know.
All right, folks, it was a good time with you, and I'm out. Cheers.
All right, let's do a quick just a quick. You guys want to do a little plug?
Oh,
yeah. Just before you go,
come
we'll
see the comic. Soup's on every Thursday. Unicorn-soup.com.
And this was,
we are also on Facebook and Twitter, and you can find those links on our website.
Excellent. Well, Jim, Jack, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Colin.
We are Brandon and Colin, Twex.com. We won't do the full outro on that. I don't need. All right. Good night, folks.
Cheers,
folks.
All right, I'm done. Thank you, dear.